Hi, welcome to One Foot in the Closet. I'm your host, Name Redacted, and I'm a queer polygender African who lives life with one foot in the closet for reasons of safety, only out to trusted friends and family, but never publicly out in the Western sense, because to do so would be unsafe, as in the country I currently live in, it is illegal to be queer and anything but cisgender. In this podcast, I will interview queer Africans, both on the continent and in the diaspora, who live like I do, with one foot in the closet. Each guest has chosen their own pseudonym, as we are trying to create as safe and engaging a space as possible. I believe conversations like this are not only important, but necessary to help provide a counter-narrative to the predominant Western narrative of coming out. You don't have to have a bold public declaration to come out. You can exist with one foot in the closet for safety, like I do, and that's perfectly valid and deserves more representation. I would like to unpack the privilege of coming out through this podcast and how not everyone has access to this privilege. This podcast aims to give a platform to queer Africans to tell their own stories in their own words in a way that is safe to them. Today, we welcome back Double Dealer for part two of their interview. That was such a powerful story you shared about how your friend changed and went from being somebody who was saying homophobic statements to growing and learning. And because like the potential for growth amongst people, I believe, is immense. And a lot of people sideline people because of things that they've said, which is perfectly valid. I've done it in the past. When someone says something that, you know, is queerphobic or ableist or something, then you're like, you know, like, I don't want anything to do with that person. But when somebody shows you that they can grow and that they can change, it's truly remarkable to witness.
I actually know of one bizarre story about someone who had hate crimed someone before, but is now technically has a gay bestie.
Oh, wow.
Which is so wild to me because someone from their school was a mutual, like a friend of, let me get letters for the names. Let's say person S was the hate crimer. And then there's me. And then person S's gay bestie at the moment, a friend of mine, that's A. So A was at S's school where that incident happened. Yeah. And when A heard that S hangs out with the K-Besties, she was so perplexed because that was not the same person she attended high school with. So the capability of growth is immense because many times people are homophobic for the simple reason of not having any personal relationship with someone who's queer or someone who they know is queer. Yeah. So eventually they do, and they actually do feel guilt, which I feel is well deserved. But yeah, that's a start. It's a start. Yeah. So the power of you being queer to friends of yours and changing their whole perspective around queer people is immense.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, those relationships between queer and non-queer people can definitely go a long way towards changing perspectives and stereotypes and all these homophobic beliefs. Because once you realize that somebody, I've seen it happen when like somebody realizes that like everything that they hate about a particular group of people is everything that I am, and I'm their friend. And then they like, you know, like have that moment where they're like, but they're trying to reconcile because they're realizing that everything they hate is in a friend of theirs. And if they're able to grow from that, and I believe they should be able to also hold themselves accountable for the things that they've done in the past and the harms that they've caused, because I don't think people should get away scot-free because they've, you know, grown and learned. I think people should still be held accountable for the harms that they've caused to people in the past. So the next topic that we're going to get into is sex and love. Can you tell me more about why you wanted to talk about sex and love?
There's a lot of bloodlines in between. And like it's been a huge topic of contention of mine. is because I came to uni with a kind of a goal to sexually explore, find out what I like and whatnot. And in the process, I did happen to catch a couple of like feelings and whatnot. But a lot of people are not able to reconcile the whole sex and love topic. Let's take me, for example. The thing that are going to make me like liking someone is like quality time, maybe around them, and like physical touch in a non-sexual context, right? And many a time I will like approach someone strictly like sexually and whatnot, and like we'll get our way with each other. And I like to keep people close. I like to like stay and like find out how you think, find out what bothers you, what doesn't. So a lot in that topic will get like really close. And as someone who has a history of bloodlines between friendship and like romantic encounters, I end up making those bloodlines once I start to indulge myself into someone. Yeah. But like many a time, they'll think I'm just there for the sex, which is a very, how do I put it? It gets back to like the hookup culture thing. Yeah, because personally, falling in love is progressive for me. So it's not going to be like I come with the intentions of falling in love with you. It's going to grow with. But I think the blame could like fall on me and the other people I've been with is definitely one of us will not notice the growth from us just being like a casual relationship that talks to me actually getting attached. And I feel like I deserve to explore more of that. I need to, be more about it. But many a time, people on first encounter will be worried that I'm going to like catch feelings and whatnot, and I don't know how to deal with it. And it's a silence that does the most harm for me, because if we are progressively getting tighter, and I am checking up on you at midnight, I'm sending TikToks, we are talking about specifically nothing for hours on end, I'm going to presume we're both seeing the trajectory of where this is going. Yeah. So there's a lot of, I know like the submission I just gave is very, it has no particular ending, and that like particularly describes my whole relationship with sex and love. But then definitely, I am not one person to confine all my romantic like encounters to physicality. So definitely, I'm able to experience physicality outside of romance and vice versa, which is a very confusing thing to many people, myself inclusive, because I will not know what I'm going for till like the very last minute. And most of the time will be end up being like cross purposes with many people. And yeah, I'd like to know if like the other people out there have issues with this. Yeah. Or like issue like solutions. I can talk with a particular person though about like polyamory and like open relationships and whatnot. And like for the first time I felt seen, because they were technically just describing what I go through on a daily. And like due to the frustration of it all, I just end up dropping all pursuits to like a healthy romantic relationship.
Well, if there's anybody listening who can relate and who has any possible advice or anything that they could contribute to this conversation, please feel free to write in and I'll pass on the message to Double Lila. It's a complicated topic because sex and love are so interlinked. For me, it's difficult to be casually, I've never had like a casual sexual relationship. Because whenever I like even like engage in like kissing with somebody, the feelings come. And so people are different. And for me, I just like try to like not engage in anything unless I am interested in a romantic relationship with somebody, because I know if I do engage, then the feelings will come and then that will just complicate things. But everybody is different. Everybody has their own, ways of moving through the world. And polyamory is a wonderful thing to explore that a lot of my friends have had a wonderful time with. And sex and love, it's a very complicated issue, as you said, because it requires so much communication back and forth to decide, you know, like, are we happy with this relationship in the state that it's in right now? Or would we like to transition into something else? Or would we like to transition into something completely, entirely different? But I think that communication is a key, as you said before. And as you said before, communicating throughout the process of getting to know somebody and checking in on the status of the relationship and checking in on how things are going is very important. So this next topic that we're going to get into, I'm going to give another trigger warning, a content warning, because this is another one that is a sensitive topic. And so if anybody feels triggered or doesn't want to listen to this next part of this interview, you can feel free to skip ahead and we'll have the time markers in the description. So you said that you wanted to talk about predators.
I believe I encountered a few, though. When you're in the whole being, you know, preyed on situation, it doesn't exactly click. But like, there's a couple of, I'd say, grinder gays that look out for a specific age demographic. Like that initial getting to knowing more queer people, there was barely any other way but, you know, to use the dating app. Yeah, and many a time you have someone who would not respect your boundaries because as not ready to like have penetrative sex. But this one person kept on pushing for it. And at a moment, they tried to deploy pity party tactics, like something to go with, like, you promise you do this, but then you fail. Because like, I was like, okay, I'm going to try, but like, if I'm not doing it, we're going to stop. So I did, and I was like, no, it's not giving. We should stop. And we did, and they did a kind of PT kind of thing, which is very, yeah. But luckily, I think I was very self-aware with what I wanted to do at the moment. So I was able to avoid that completely. And yeah, and detach from the whole situation, which a lot of queer people don't get the chance to, because you're finally in this accepting space and you have the option of, one, you know, getting the person who's introducing you to more queer spaces angry, or like going through this slight inconvenience. And like a lot of people would rather go through the slight inconvenience to keep the feeling of safety around, which I believe is not right. And I think I did mention a topic about baby gays in what I wrote down. I feel like this would be a perfect time to include that, is when many people are getting introduced into gay spaces, they don't get to be introduced in a healthy way. Usually a lot of sexual stuff and a lot of people trying to be your first and, like, you know, have you before you're, you know, more experienced in the community. And there's not enough, like, I'd say, like, media or conversation about how to get into healthy gay spaces at the beginning of your sexual discovery journey, which I feel should be. It's because in the queer books, you're going to see people's first queer encounters are going to be like with a lover. And like, there's really never a platonic, you know, initiation into what being a gay person without having gay sex is, which I feel is crucial for many other people that have been in situations that they would rather have not, but for, you know, it was the lesser evil than, you know, getting back, you know, getting both feet back into the closet and being reserved to yourself.
Definitely. The issues of predators amongst the queer community is rampant and it's honestly terrible to see. I remember one of my brother's roommates was a teacher and he would like be a predator and engage in sexual relationships with his own students who were of high school age. Yeah. And like, he would like proudly say this, you know, as like, like he was proud of his exploits, which is disgusting. And I felt so sorry for these poor students who, you know, were baby gays, as you said, or baby queers, who didn't really, you know, because like at that age, all the fault goes to the predator, you know? All the fault goes to the person who is the older person in the scenario, preying on the young person's lack of knowledge and lack of understanding of the situation. And it's a very, very, very terrible situation to be in. And I'm sorry that you went through what you went through. But it's definitely one of those things where, as you said, we need more. Like, I mean, it's hard in countries like the ones that we live in, but we need more institutions that can like cater to baby queers and like help them, guide them on their journey of queerness in a safe space, in a way that is like a resource for baby queers to explore their sexuality in a non-sexual way, you know? Like when there's like resource groups, like when I was initially starting to come out to people, I was able to find a resource group that met up filled with bisexual and pansexual people. And it was a great resource to me because it was like not sexual in any way whatsoever. It was just people talking about their experiences, talking about how they came to their queerness, and it really, really helped me on my journey. But these resources are hard to find, especially in places like where we live. And I mean, that's like part of the reason that I'm trying to do this podcast, is to help add an additional resource to queer Africans on the continent, so that we can know that we're not as alone, and that there are people out there who are going through the same things. Thank you for sharing. So next, we can get into children and the exposure to queerness.
There's this a jump to a conclusion that once anyone is talking about queerness to children, it's sexual and it shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be
when yeah. Sorry, could I just interject and say that jump to conclusion is never made when it comes to heterosexuality?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So like I have a little sibling, and I'm always like, I don't know how to, you know, how to healthily be able to engage her with like queer content. So many a time, if it's like any queer content, I will just act like I'm not seeing what they're saying. But yeah, I definitely believe there should be more better content for children to interact with in queer shows, yeah? And representation is not exactly of a sexual nature, because if it's a family movie, it would make no sense to put an R-rated scene. So there should be more like positivity around queer characters, you know, queer parents in shows generally. So yeah, because when it comes in person, I will definitely be like around my sibling, because I can be very gender non-conforming, and we are like, everyone is very cool with that. And I feel that that's how children should be, you know, introduced to queer spaces, is like drag shows, dress, and not exactly sexual content, like many people presume it would be. Yeah, and children are way more ready to understand queerness than many people presume they are not. Yeah. Because my sibling will never question why I don't exactly act like other imams. And it's a very normal thing for them. Yeah. And surprise, surprise, we were, because they are the AFAB and the very mask as a child, and there was the utter opposite. So it's a very interesting combination at home. Yeah, so I believe there should be more queer positive energy when it comes to children. Mm-hmm.
I wholeheartedly agree. I have a little sibling as well who I was trying to expose to queer content in the similar ways that you were doing when we were growing up. And they unfortunately internalized a lot of the queerphobic things in our society, and they responded with a lot of queerphobic rhetoric. But then, like a couple years later, when they were in their early 20s, they came out to me as queer. And had just like internalized so much of that rhetoric. But like, at the same time, they said that they were grateful to me for like exposing them to things like Glee, you know, and shows like that, where like queerness is represented. But on like the more like children's side of things, like there's like amazing shows like She-Ra and the Princesses of Power, which has like queer characters, and it's a cartoon, and it's, you know, like done like, you know, in like romantic, like completely non-sexual way, you know, in the ways that heterosexual characters in cartoons can kiss and can get married and all these things. But like, you know, it doesn't have to be sexual. But the unfortunate thing about that is like there was like this controversy with the movie Lightyear, where there was a queer couple in it that kissed, and then it got banned in so many countries, and so many countries protested against it. And like, I feel like those like reactions from queerphobic countries towards something as simple as a queer kiss in a cartoon, they really, really set back the cause with trying to expose children to queerness in a way that is non-sexual. You said that you wanted to get into the never-ending self-discovery. Can you elaborate?
Okay, yeah. So initially, I always knew I was queer of sorts. Yeah, but I think at the beginning more by curious, because I never exactly explored a romantic relationship with someone of the same sex. But then I did, and then at the moment, I identified as bisexual. But then looking back at like other experiences, bisexual didn't exactly sit right. So yeah, I did a lot of like reading, I like definitions, and yeah, I ended up at the conclusion that I am definitely pansexual. But that's not the end of it. Especially for like non-monosexual people, is you always have those questions of, is this just a rush to me being gay? Am I even actually gay? There's a lot of uncertainties as you move on with life. And like, it's fine. It should be fine. I've created peace with it, and I'm definitely the better for it, because I no longer worry about what, you know, what am I presenting as, and more of what am I feeling at the moment. Do I want to be with this person? Does this make me feel nice? And that's a better approach, because for many of us, the questions never end. The self-doubt never ends. And living in a constant state of mad self-doubt is a very unhealthy way to live. Yeah. So definitely, you should make peace with the fact that you're not always going to be like precise about how you feel about your sexuality and or gender expression.
Exactly. No, I've had a similar journey where, especially relating to my gender expression and sexuality, because at first I was like, am I gay, or am I trans woman, or am I gender queer? Am I, you know, like, and as we grow and as we learn more and as we develop a better understanding of the different terms and the terminologies and the like breadth of the gender spectrum and the breadth of the sexuality spectrum, because it's so wide and it's such a large spectrum, but so many people put people into these small individual boxes. But the journey of self-discovery, I'm grateful that you've continued to be on it, and I'm grateful that you've come to a sense of better peace with yourself and with the relationships that you engage in, because that only helps yourself and helps the queer community at large, honestly. So thank you. This is related to the never-ending self-discovery. You said that you wanted to discuss the elusive nature of gender. And you said many a time, I have existential questions on whether or not gender is real.
Yeah, I think I did kind of talk about it. And like every time I try to put it to words, it doesn't seem to sit right, because most times I'll express myself and articulate according to how I'm feeling. So when how I'm feeling is not definite, I find it so hard to put it in words. But to simplify it, it's like I keep questioning, is there an extreme of genders, like a masculine and feminine? actually existent, or is the version we're getting utterly watered down? Because when you look through history, there's been a significant, like a masculine trait, a significant feminine trait, significant, you know, genderqueer traits. And like, I keep asking myself, so how do you know what is real anymore? Given the whole, since like the coming of media and like the standardizing of how people should express each other, express themselves, is very confusing. That's the frustration I've been going through. Is it real? Is it not real? Is what I'm going through just like a reaction to what has been painted out to be, you know, the norm? Or if there was no norm, would I still feel, you know, averse to acting a certain way or being made to act a certain way? Yeah. Or being expected to be a certain way? Yeah. Many times it's like, if like all external influence was void, what would my gender expression be? But then gender is what society makes it. So I keep having like that loop of questions. And I'm yet to find a steady point.
Well, I wish you the best on your journey of discovery and on your journey of your gender expression and just these concepts of gender that you're wrestling with. I'm personally of the view that gender is a social construction and that it was socially constructed to keep certain people in power. And if you look throughout history, you can see that these traits that are masculine and these traits that are feminine have changed over time. Like certain things that were regarded as feminine used to be masculine, and certain things that were regarded as masculine used to be feminine. And so for me, that shows me that it's all just socially constructed in order to keep certain people in power, namely cishet men. And I encourage you to explore and to express your gender in whatever way feels comfortable to you, because at the end of the day, I mean, you have to live in the society that you live in, unfortunately. But if you can express it in a way that is comfortable to you and in a way that helps you get through the day, that's what's most important. And so best of luck with your continued journey. And so the next topic that I wanted to get into is, you said that you wanted to discuss homophobic family.
Because it's like really hard.
Mm-hmm.
In me being more comfortable in my queerness, it was very easy to like get rid of homophobic like colleagues and whatnot. But that's never the case with homophobic family, especially for the younger queers, where many of us are like dependent. It's like a survival trope, and like it's never ending, because like you really love these people, but they dread the very existence of you. And like you really don't know how to feel about that. You don't know how to go about it. So yeah, personally, I came to the conclusion that I don't exactly owe anyone coming out. I will only do it if it's benefiting my comfort. So whenever they find out, they will find out. I'm like, I'm not going to exactly deny if they find out, but I'm also not going to come out, like actively come out, because that is only going to be a downhill road for me. And that should be kind of normalized, because at the end of the day, you want to live to be happy and your peace should be preserved. And if you not coming out to your family is what's going to keep your peace, then so be it. It's okay to, I usually say this statement that two things can be true. Your family could hate the very existence of you and still love you very much. So at the moment, you shouldn't exactly bother yourself with whatever is going on in their minds. And you should choose the best course of action given, you know, how independent you can be regardless of their input, whether you'll be physically safe when they know, and if they're going to be able to discern on who and who not to tell about your queerness.
Exactly. No, I've been in a similar boat where I have like the majority of my family is homophobic, or queerphobic, and I am not out to the majority of them because it's not safe for me to do so. And my safety and my peace is the utmost importance to me, you know? And so I'm completely on the same wavelength with you of it's a very fine line to walk when you realize that like somebody like hates a part of you, but still loves you. And it's a very uncomfortable situation to be in. One of the inspirations behind this podcast was the web series Brown Girls by Fatima Asghar, who's a queer creator as well. And the coming out scene of the character was like the most similar to a coming out scene that I've had, where they came out to their sibling, but then they immediately said, "Don't tell auntie." You know? And like that was one of the inspirations behind this podcast, because like that's like so many of our lives where it's like we have to live with one foot in the closet for reasons of safety and for reasons of peace of mind, because especially if you are dependent, I'm dependent on family for shelter and for food and for other reasons, and you don't want to put yourself in a situation where you are potentially, you know, experiencing homelessness or struggling in some other way. And so you just have to navigate as best as you can. And I don't think that being publicly out is the only way, you know, there's like a whiteness to that. And there's like a Western sense to that narrative. And so you navigate things in the ways that are best for you, and protect your peace of mind, most definitely. All right. So you also wanted to get into African queer stories. Can you elaborate on that?
As I have not been able to interact with a lot of African queer stories, and like non-African based queer stories are very pretty and they can be beautiful, but there's a certain level of detachment when you're reading something that's like not part of what you normally go through. And I believe that's how most people interact with like their sexuality and whatnot, is through media. And when there's nowhere in the media, you know, portraying an ideal, a healthy situation of what you being in a relationship would be, it kind of gets to you. It kind of creates that, you know, that feeling of, you know, maybe I might not be able to get into a nice relationship, or maybe queer Africans are not meant to, you know, get into relationships. There's a whole statement said by, in quotes, woke Africans that are like fine with queerness, but still uphold the whole heteronormative family issue. Is they will say, I know queer people have existed forever, but there's a reason we have heteronormative families in Africa, and that's like for, you know, the way of life, and like you should follow it. So many a time, many people will be pulled into that because they don't know what an alternative would be like. I feel like for the low-key queer writers, there should be like a kind of network that plugs relatively incognito writing, because like posting it out for the main public could be problematic, but like circulating it around queer circles would definitely be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, I know of a couple of queer short stories that I could share with you after this podcast. In terms of queer representation across the African continent, it's difficult because a lot of our countries are queerphobic. Like, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the film Rafiki.
No.
It was a Kenyan queer film, which was banned in Kenya and had a whole lot of like government was like very strictly against it, but it ended up being like nominated for an Oscar, but it wasn't even screened in Kenya. And so I feel like that's what a lot of queer artists struggle with, is the fact that their content is repressed by their own governments, especially on the African continent. And that like is a real struggle with a lot of queer African artists who are trying to create art that is authentic to the queer African experience. But I can share a couple of stories with you. And in regards to queer stories of queer Africans, this podcast will have plenty of them, including yours, Double Dealer. So thank you for sharing. I hope that we can also contribute towards the discourse of having more representation of queer African stories. All right. So next, you said that you wanted to get into the first time you faced homophobia, and you say in brackets, "I didn't even know it was a thing." Tell me more about that.
Oh, yes. Yes, I remember very well. My primary school, it was pretty normal for people to be like gender non-conforming. I was like, no shade around it. Like, you'll be with a couple of dudes and no one will be like, you know, teasing you about being or not being that standard, why not? So I kind of did grow up in a not homophobic environment. It was just more people just minding their business. So moving to Form 1 secondary school, I had a friend of mine tell me, oh, by the way, the boys in your dormitory might bully you because you act like a girl. And like, it really did make sense, because why would you? Yeah, it couldn't register until it happened. And I was like, wow, because that's not even like sexually exploring my queerness. It's just being a very happy little fairy. And these people are very impressed about it. And yeah, it made, you know, my beginning of secondary very, very shitty. Yeah, I wouldn't like to get into the details, but yeah, no, it's pretty much it.
I'm sorry to hear that, and I'm sorry that you went through that. That sounds like a terrible experience. Okay, so we can move on from that into the whole conversation from when people say it's okay to be queer, but you can't base your whole life off of it.
Yes, so this is like such a thing about many people being only queer, and how you have people in the background saying, you know, you cannot just be queer your entire life. It's like a purely a repressive statement made from like a privileged stance of many straight people. And like, to a certain angle, it does have a relative truth to it. It takes me back to people staying in toxic places, because toxic queer spaces, because the alternative would be not having a safe queer space. So I believe queer people should be comfortable being queer away from queer spaces. You don't have to be like loud and unequivocal about it, but like, you should be able to realize when a queer space is being toxic, right? When it's getting bad for you, and you should be able to eject yourself from that. It's like the one way I feel like that statement would make sense is, you're not only queer, you're a person with like mental health needs. And if, you know, you getting to be in a safe queer space is affecting like your mental health and all your physical interactions, I believe at that moment you should be able to move away from, because it's just being toxic. Yeah. And other related situations that I might not be able to think of at the moment, but at a point where you living your queer truth is affecting many other aspects of your life, I believe at that point, you should remember that your life does not only encircle around your queer identities. You have other aspects of your life that you should take care of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I know. Thank you for sharing that. Because, I mean, the thing with that is also, like, there are people who are, like, pro-Black and, like, all for the Black cause and blackity, blackity, Black. And you don't get that same reaction of you can't base your whole life around your race, you know? And so, like, I feel like that's a double standard, because I feel like queerness should be celebrated. And if you're a queer person who wants to celebrate that, that should be celebrated and celebrated by people in your life. It shouldn't be minimized or invalidated or made to seem like you're basing your whole life around it, when you are a multifaceted individual. You have many different aspects to yourself, and you're not basing your whole life off of it. You're just celebrating yourself. But I think that celebration can rub some people the wrong way and can make people feel like they must put you down because something about it, whether they're internalized queer phobia or whatnot, rubs them the wrong way, which is unfortunate. So you said that one particular important topic that you wanted to get into was how, because of the difficulty of finding safe spaces to be queer, often we endanger ourselves for the short feeling of ecstasy of being our authentic selves. Endanger could be physically and even emotionally by keeping yourself in a toxic environment. You got into this with your last question, but would you like to elaborate more upon that?
There happens to be like sort of underground queer party scene, and some of those places and like, people there are very questionable. And given the fact that you're not dying to like find a place to, you know, to release that inner raging queer, and you wouldn't be there. So there should be some discernment. Is I think I have been to, but like we did get out of the situation. Yeah.
Okay. I'm glad you're able to get out of that situation, because it sounds like quite the toxic situation to be in. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was scary.
Okay, we're getting into our penultimate question. So second to last. So this is a question that's coming from me. And I'd just like to know, what was your first experience of queer joy?
It must have been the time where I came to terms with, you know, your presentation not being exactly how you feel. And I get these comments on like relative androgyny, and like someone could say like, you're very pretty, but like a girl, and like that would make me genuinely happy, because yes, I feel exactly like that, and no one has been able to put it in words before until you did so. Then also when a couple of friends say, give me like names that are very funny, like Gabo Dela, I was like, wow, that's new. And then there was one time a friend of mine called me a lesbian, because I give off very firm energy, but I also like, I was like, yeah. So very, very tiny snippets of people and intentionally recognizing and seeing queerness in me have been one of my best queer moments. Yeah.
That sounds amazing. I'm so glad that you got to experience that, and that you got to be celebrated for who you are, because you deserve that. Okay, so my last question for this interview is, what was your first memory of coming out to a trusted person and being celebrated?
That must have been my best friend. I feel like I was 4 years back. I was in the peak of lockdown and my mental health was in shambles. And I was fed up, and I really needed a change of scene that I was not going to get anytime soon. So on a very long phone call, I started to delve into, you know, issues about me. And yeah, I managed to say a lot. It was like my ultimate coming out. Because usually, a label doesn't exactly explain your queer experience, which is how I've been coming out most lately.
Mm-hmm.
But like then I went into words. I did have words for much of what I was feeling, but I put it in descriptive words, and it was so comforting. And you know, they acknowledged the whole one foot in the closet thing, which made me feel seen because of the context. And yeah, it was nice, because for the very first time I was speaking about my queerness. It was the very first time I had myself say my queerness out loud.
That sounds like an amazing experience, and I'm so glad that you had that, and I'm so glad that you have that friend in your life, and that you have people who celebrate you for who you are, because once again, you deserve it. And thank you so much for joining me for this interview, Double Dealer. I appreciate you for taking the time to share so openly and honestly about your experiences with queerness and gender expression and everything else that we dealt upon on this interview. It's been a very wide-ranging interview, and you've shared a lot that will really, I feel, help a lot of people, especially a lot of baby queers who might be listening in and might resonate with a lot of what you said. I know that I personally resonated with a lot of what you said. We had a couple back and forths where I was really, really hit hard by a lot of what you shared. So thank you so much for coming on today. And I really appreciate your time. And thank you so much for sharing so openly and honestly. I appreciate you, Double Dealer.
thank you too for, you know, this whole experience. I was very excited and I could barely do anything for like the past 2 hours. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Thank you so much.
This was One Foot in the Closet. If you'd like to support our podcast, please subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And please take the time to leave a rating and review, especially on Apple Podcasts. It really helps. We'd love to hear back from you. Wherever you're listening in from, please share your thoughts with us via email at onefootinthecloset@gmail.com. Like our Facebook page, One Foot in the Closet. Follow our Instagram at One Foot in Closet and follow our Twitter at One Foot in Closet. Please send any messages, thoughts, comments, and questions via social media or email. One Foot in the Closet was created by Name Redacted, hosted by Name Redacted, theme music by Annie King Smith, edited by Annie King Smith. Mixed and produced by Drew Deacon Thomas. This project was funded by House of African Feminisms, a project of the Goethe Institute, Kigali, Lagos, and Johannesburg.